Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Natalie Wright. Welcome to another episode of the World Shapers, World Shippers. This is episode number 139, and this episode's guest will be, as I just said, Natalie Wright. My name is Edward Willett. I am the host, and I am also a writer of science fiction and fantasy, and also a publisher. My most recent release is actually Soulworm, which is a new edition of my debut novel, which was shortlisted for Best First Book when it came out at the Saskatchewan Book Awards way back in 1997. It's a contemporary fantasy, except since I wrote it so long ago, it's actually set when it was written, so it's actually set in the 80s, which gives it kind of a Stranger Things vibe. It's a young adult novel, and that one's out now from my Shadow Paw Press. My most recent novel from another publisher is The Tangled Stars, which is a far future humorous outer space adventure that features an AI-uplifted talking cat who becomes a starship captain, and that's published by Daw Books. It's my 12th novel for Daw Books. So those are some of my most recent things. However, Shadow Paw Press, which published Soulworm, is increasingly publishing, well, all sorts of things, and not just science fiction and fantasy, but two upcoming novels from Shadow Paw Press. Looks like they'll be in early 2024, are The Good Soldier by Nir Yaniv and The Headmasters by Mark Morton. The former is a satirical, I guess you'd call it anti-military or military satire anyway, called The Good Soldier. And there is, in fact, a famous satire called The Good Soldier that it's kind of a riff on. And it's also, I think, Starship Troopers meets Catch-22 in outer space or something like that would kind of describe it. And then the other one, The Headmasters, is a young adult post-apocalyptic, I guess, though the apocalypse is very specific. Called The Headmasters, as I said, and it is young adult and features characters who are controlled by some sort of mysterious invaders from another dimension. So that's coming up from Shadowpaw Press, as I said, probably in 2024, and the reason for the delay is that Shadowpaw Press is now part of the Literary Press Group of Canada. As part of that, I have joined a distribution network called LitDistCo. And as part of that, I'm also joining a sales force that LPG offers. And all of those things together means that I can't be quite as freewheeling as I have been in the past with publishing schedules. I'm going to have to time things to line up with what the sales force needs in order to represent the books to bookstores. But it should mean that Shadowpaw Press books will become more available and more noticeable in bookstores and hopefully more sales for the authors. And as I said, I publish other stuff in science fiction fantasy. I've got a number of historical novels, reprints, but also coming up still on the science fiction and fantasy side is the Empire Kaz series, Empire of Kaz trilogy, actually, by Leslie Gadala. The first two books in that were originally published by Del Rey. And then the Canadian Chills middle grade ghost story trilogy, not really a trilogy because it's not the same characters, so call it a short series, I guess, by Arthur Slade, who is a guest on the podcast and who is a Governor General's Award-winning author. And these are some of his early novels, which were originally published by Kato Books, which unfortunately went bankrupt, and I've picked up a number of their authors in reprints. So all of that is going on. I'm also working on a nonfiction book, which will feature writing advice and quotes from people I've interviewed on this podcast, specifically some of my Canadian authors. I decided to focus it on Canadians. Since I'll probably publish it through Shadowpaw Press, it might go to another Canadian publisher, but anyway, I'm working on that now. So lots going on as well as the podcast, but I'm always happy to interview authors and to continue this podcast as it approaches its fifth anniversary, which will be at the beginning of next month, the beginning of August. And this episode's guest, as I said, is Natalie Wright. Natalie Wright writes fantasy and science fiction novels and short stories. She's the author of the award-winning HALF series and Emily's House, a young adult novel with more than 2 million reads worldwide. Natalie also co-hosts the popular SFF podcast, Tipsy Nerds Book Club. When she's not writing, you might find Natalie with an Xbox controller in her hand, cooking French food for friends, or sipping a bourbon cocktail, probably not all three at the same time. Natalie lives in Arizona with her husband and two ornery cats, and visits her college-aged son frequently in New York City. So, Natalie, welcome to the World Shapers.
Thank you for having me.
We're laughing because there was a little technical glitch there that hopefully when you hear the edited part, you won't even know existed, but we know it existed. So it's great to have you on, and I always try to look for connections. We've never met. I was born in New Mexico. That's close to Arizona. And I have a college-age daughter, so there you go. So we do have a few things kind of in common. So let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. Where were you born? Where did you grow up? And how did you get interested in writing? Probably you started as a reader. Most of us did.
Yeah, I was born in Ohio, and but I haven't lived there for a long, long time. But it's the place of my birth. And in terms of writing and reading, I actually was what you might call a bit of a reluctant reader. I didn't, although I could read, I didn't necessarily enjoy the books available to me. My early reading was mostly comic books. I would sit on my teenage brother's bedroom floor and read his comic books. And so I was actually more a comic book reader as a young child than a book reader.
Well, you can certainly pick up some ideas for how to keep things moving along quickly from comic books.
Yeah. But I think it was because in my small town school library, they sort of, you know, didn't necessarily have, especially for, you know, they would send girls to one section and boys to another section. That's how long ago I was a kid. And the books in the girls section didn't really appeal to me. So I think that's part of why I didn't really like to read, because I didn't want to read like Judy Blum. That just wasn't my thing. So it wasn't until someone handed me A Wrinkle in Time that I was like, oh.
That's what you've been looking for.
Right. Because I've always wanted to read or be interested in sci-fi and fantasy stories. But as a writer, I began writing when I was 4. And I wrote a story about a rabbit, because I had a pet rabbit, and it was about a tea party. And they praised my wild imagination, but as a 4-year-old, I thought this was real. So, you know, because kids have a great, you know, imagination. Anyway, so I've really been writing my whole life, I would say.
So people did read your writing, even, you know, your very early stuff? You were never shy about showing it to people?
Well, I think it was a story, you know, some of my early stories, you know, you'd write little things for class or, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And oddly, I kept winning prizes for writing, but I didn't start writing for real until I was 40. So I don't know what's up with that. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, oh, you're pretty good at this. Yeah, but, and I went and did a lot of other things. But, didn't really come back to it seriously until my 40s.
Well, what were some of the other things that you did then? What did you do up until you were 40?
Well, for some reason, I thought it was a good idea to go to law school and become a lawyer. Do that for quite some time. Practicing divorce law. So that was, you know, interesting.
Well, it pays better than writing, I can. That's for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yes, it does. It does do that. But there's a cost if you're doing something you don't love. So
you went to
that you don't enjoy that. Yeah.
You went, where did you go to law school?
Ohio State.
And were you still writing all through that time, even though you were, I mean, obviously once you begin studying law, there's a lot of reading and writing, but were you still writing for fun during all those years that you were lawyering?
Well, I really didn't. I mean, I think it really sucked all the creative energy out of me, but yeah. And you know, When you're practicing law, going to law school, it's very intense, and you're obviously reading and writing a lot. And so I continued writing nonfiction pieces, like legal journal articles and things like that. And then ridiculously thought that when I started writing fiction, somehow that translated over and it really doesn't. You know, like writing fiction is a completely different beast than writing nonfiction articles. So, you know, there was a learning curve there. But, yeah, I sort of stopped writing for a long time.
Were you still reading?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But there was a long time I didn't read a lot of fiction. I just was really into nonfiction. But, yeah, always a reader, for sure.
Were you always, when you were reading fiction, was it still tending towards the fantastical side of things?
Yeah, I would say in college I picked up Anne Rice novels. And between Margaret Atwood and Anne Rice, there was this long period where that was kind of like, it feels like, I'm sure I read other things, but that's all I remember reading. You know, every single thing that Anne Rice wrote, I read it. And every single thing that Margaret Atwood wrote, I read. And there were a few others, but yeah.
It's an interesting mixture.
Lots of sci-fi fantasy. Yeah, I know, right? But
I'd love to see what Margaret Atwood would do with a vampire novel, actually. It would probably be very interesting. I should get AI to write one for me. I'm sure it could. So.
Yeah, lots. There's so many different writers, you know, that I read over that period of time. But I would say that getting back into reading more seriously came when I started writing again, because the two really need to come together and you need to study. In order to get better at writing, you need to study reading. So then I got back into reading and a lot more.
So how did you make that switch then from lawyering to deciding that you were going to get back into your writing? What was the impetus?
Well, I birthed a child, and I think the creativity generally of having a new person, a little one in your life, and, you know, children are just such an amazing creative energy. I mean, watching them learn to be human is quite an amazing process. Mm-hmm. So I think that just really sort of got me back into creative pursuits in general. I dipped my toe back into painting and art, which was something that I did in college. And then, but I felt frustrated with that because I had let that creative muscle go so long. I didn't really know how to do it anymore. So I think that writing came more naturally because I had never stopped writing. I had stopped writing fiction, right? But it wasn't like I'd stopped using words. So that felt a little more natural. And a story just came to me. My first novel was a story that just came out of dreams and visions that I had. It kind of popped in from nowhere. And then I chased it down, and soon I was writing a story, and pretty soon, you know, I had a whole novel. And it was terrible, but I had one.
Well, you sort of touched on something there, because you said that, you know, the kind of writing you were doing didn't really feed into writing fiction. Yet at the same time, using words at all does kind of tie into writing fiction, doesn't it? I mean, at least you knew how to put sentences together and grammatically and spell things, presumably.
Right. That's exactly right. I would say I never, you know, I had never stopped. I had never stopped, you know, yeah, using words and writing. And so to get back into, you know, writing fiction, it was more about then learning, you know, how to create a story. As a lawyer, in a way, you create stories because when you go to a courtroom, you have to tell your client's story. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to put together something that convinces the trier of facts that what your client wants, desires, or is requesting, you know, matches the facts. And that was kind of a kind of storytelling.
Constructing a narrative, at least.
Right. But how to do that in a way in fiction, this is where I'm saying, I thought, oh, well, that will be fine. I've kind of been doing that all along. Yeah, not really. And then when you go to write a work of fiction, especially a novel, or a longer piece, you know, there's a lot of moving parts in a novel, and it's not as easy as it looks. And if you've never done it, when you first try, you find that out.
The that long history of lawyering also obviously would have brought you into contact with a lot of people, a lot of different situations, a lot of characters, if you like. Does all of that background feed into your fiction writing then? I think, I mean, we all bring whatever's in our background into our fiction, but is that specifically true for you?
Well, I, by design, do not write about anything having to do with the law. So some retired or what we call recovering lawyers, you know,
kind of niche as a lawyer, so
right, kind of gravitate to writing legal things like legal thrillers and stuff like that.
Well, I was thinking more of the, like, just the being exposed to the slice of life that you're exposed to in that kind of lawyering in particular.
Yeah, I would say being really surrounded by human beings and their, you know, their dramas, their stories for a long period of time, I think it definitely influences me. My last years as a lawyer, I primarily focused on being a mediator. So I would meet with both parties to a divorce case or to a child custody situation together. And I often found myself really able to see both sides. And so I think that where that comes into my writing is being able to see more than just one character in the story. And I think that readers and reviewers pick up on this sometimes where I really do see each character as having a complete story. And even if it's an antagonist, I'm really able to see what drives them and what pulls them into this narrative. So I think that that's probably influenced by this long period of time of listening to both parties in a story.
So how did you move from starting to write and discovering that it was difficult to write a novel to being a published writer? When did that happen for you?
Yeah, well, it's been, you know, a process. I started writing probably seriously in 2008, so it's been a while. I didn't go to college and get like a master's degree, but I started going to workshops that I could locally. I live in Arizona, and a lot of, you know, writers will come here and visit in the winter and then do workshops. So I would take as many classes as I could. Got involved in writing groups, you know, critique partners, writing, getting it critiqued, and then books, lots of books, you know, everything from like how to write a novel or, you know, the art of war to you name it. I mean, I don't know. I picked it up and started going through it and doing the exercises and just studying it. I think that, though, one of my favorite quotes is the best way out is through. And I think that with writing, that really applies. So the best way to write a novel, learn how to write a novel, is to write one. Mm-hmm. And then tear it apart and do it again. And then again and again and again. And for me, it was somewhere around maybe the fifth novel that I felt like I really got it. Like, that doesn't mean that they're perfect, because they're not, but
no such, you know, thing as a perfect novel.
right. You still have a lot of work to do, but to feel like all the parts were connected. Like, the first novel I wrote is very plot driven. We have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it, you know, it does the job. But then to work on character development, then to work on scene, and then down to beats and all of that. One thing with writing classes or workshops, often I felt like I would go, and I remember, I mean, I hadn't even finished writing one novel and they were talking about beats. How can you think of a beat when you're still trying to decide how to connect the beginning to the end, right? For me, that felt overwhelming. Like, to talk about the minutiae of the sentence level or paragraph level writing. So for me, things like, there is, I don't know if you've heard of Randy Ingermanson and his snowflake method.
No.
That really helped me to sort of get this idea of how to go from the macroscopic to the microscopic. Because someone sitting there talking to me about beats just like went right over my head when I was first started. I couldn't even think about that.
Well, here's my confession. Lots of people I talk to talk about beats. I have never in my life even thought of the term when I'm writing or how they apply. I just write.
Yeah, I
I
agree.
20 novels in, but you know what? I don't even know what a beat is supposed to be, to tell you the truth. I've never looked it up. So that's my little
Yeah.
confession as a writer.
Agreed. I mean, I sort of maybe now if someone talks about it, get it. But yeah, my writing process is way too organic to be sitting there thinking about beats in the moment. But yeah, the point being, sometimes as a new writer or as, new-ish, people will use all these terms and make it seem so complex, and it is, but at the same time, you still have to entertain someone with a story they actually want to read. And if you're down to the minutiae all the time, I think sometimes things can get lost.
So, what was your first published novel or story? And when was that?
Well, I self-published my first novel, Emily's House, in 2011. Again, thought that was a good idea. It sort of was, because at the time, self-publishing was just beginning to be like something that a lot of people were doing, and it was starting to be taken seriously. This was the moment in time when Hugh Howey was writing Wool as an episodic and getting, and selling a gazillion copies. Amanda Hocking that year, I think it was either 2010 or 11, was the first person to sell over 1 million copies of a story on Kindle, and got picked up by, I think it's St. Martin's Press, for a six-figure book deal.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So I'm like, oh, Wattpad was sort of new, and I put my story on there, and someone liked it and recommended it be featured. And they did feature it. And then it had like, 1,000 reads, and then it was 20,000, and then it was 30,000, and then it was several hundred thousand. And pretty soon it was a million. And I was like, wow, okay. The story is still there, it's still free, and it's now been read over 2 million times worldwide. So even though anyone who's a writer would go and say, well, that's really amateur. I mean, it's one of those stories where it's like every thought I ever had, let's put it all in one book. Classic first story, first novel syndrome. There's something about it, I guess, that has entertained people. And so from there, then I self-published that whole series, then I self-published another series. And then from there, it's a little bit more of a long, convoluted story, but now I've got seven novels out in the world.
Well, and let's talk about how you go about crafting them, the creative process, and we'll focus on the new one, Season of the Dragon. It's out now, is it?
Yeah, it was published March 1st.
Okay. And of course, when I say now, it's actually as we're recording this on June 20th, but it's still some time before this goes live. So it's definitely out. So you talked a little bit about your first story, coming to you from dreams. But in general, this is the old cliche, where do you get your ideas? Where do you get your ideas? What inspires you to write novels? What's the seed from which a novel grows? Does it vary from book to book, or does it tend to be the same sort of thing? And specifically for Season of the Dragon.
Yeah, it varies, and I think it's complicated for this one because it's several different things coming together into one package. So my second series is a young adult sci-fi series, and this is just about the opposite of that, really. But I was out doing a lot of comic cons and book festivals and talking to tons of readers, and I was having this idea that I wanted to do. Get back to fantasy, and I wanted to create a magic system that was loosely based on my own feng shui practice that I've done for a long time and my Buddhist practice. So I wanted to combine elements of these two into a magic system. And loosely, I was thinking that elements would be involved and also seasons, which is very feng shui. And readers that I talked to across the country were like, yeah, that sounds kind of cool. That's neat, but put dragons in it. Like, okay. Dragons are perennial. People love dragons. For me, dragons are both, an actual physical creature in my books, but they also serve to move forward a lot of metaphor that I'm trying to work into the story. And in the first book of Season of Dragos Primary, the Season of the Dragon series, you won't really see that so much. But by the end, I think that people will get what I'm trying to do with these dragons, that they're more, it's, you know, that's hitting on two levels. But anyway, so I had this magic system and I had dragons, and then I would say characters, their story, like the theme, the idea of what is the story about, that tends to come to me more slowly. It's usually something I'm personally working through. And so just there's like a big idea. Mm-hmm. Like in Season of the Dragon, the idea was I struggle to just be me. I struggle, and I think a lot of people have that struggle, right? The great Oscar Wilde quote, be yourself because everyone else is already taken. Well, you know, we have in our hand usually a device now that's showing us how everyone else is being, and they're getting likes and clicks, and it can be very, you know, what's the word? Like pulls you in, and it's hard to just be you in our society. So this concept of just someone being themselves and embracing all of what they are was there. And I thought, how better to do that than to create a character that's literally warring with their own self, you know? So Quinn has two souls. One is bestial. It's something the other. It's dark. And then her own soul. And so it's, you know, makes it more fictionalized, this battle between these, you know, your different selves. So that's the main, that was kind of a long answer, Ed, but
that's okay.
That's kind of like,
we have an hour.
All that went into, yeah. Yeah. So each story in this series will kind of have that thing, right? Like what is, like the next one will be forgive yourself. And then I don't know for there, I'm not sure, but each one will be something you're dealing with.
We should probably have at this point some sort of synopsis of the book. So without giving anything away, what happens in the book?
Well, the very short synopsis is that a young woman's life is destroyed by a dragon, and she joins a vigilante group of rogues and mages hunting it. She soon discovers that she is, in fact, the one being hunted, as these various factions are trying to control her growing power.
And that sounds cool.
Kind of the non-spoilery.
So is this a medieval world, or what kind of a
yes
world
and
is
no.
it?
It is not Europe. It is not typical European-based fantasy. It is second world. So this is a world called Minald. My character's main country is Androssi, and it is loosely based on a combination of ancient Egyptian, Persian, and Mongolian herding culture. So I sort of fused a lot of things together for her home world. But as the story progresses, readers will go to multiple continents on this planet, and each will have a different flavor, if you will. It's medieval, but it's not European.
You'd said you kind of find things organically as you proceed. So what kind of planning, outlining do you typically do? Or are you just jump in and start writing and figure it out as you go? It sounds in this case there must have been a fair amount of world building and possibly research involved if you're combining all those various types of cultures. So what did that look like for you?
It's messy.
Messy.
It's very messy. The story from beginning to end, it took me about 7 years to go from initial concept to final story. And I study Asian art history and Buddhism and feng shui, so I was really influenced by China and Japan. But as I began the writing process, I realized that didn't really connect to me in terms of story. While I'm surrounded by these images, I didn't feel that I could authentically write about it. So I scrapped a whole bunch of what I had initially worked with and then felt my way again, more kind of like organically to it. But it's everything from literally drawing maps, literally drawing characters to, I do a lot of what are called character interviews. So this sounds like crazy making stuff, but basically I actually kind of go back into my lawyer role in a way, and I interview them like I'm an interrogator or an investigator. And I ask them a series of questions, and I'm trying to really like get into character and hear how each one of the main characters will respond to these questions. Really helps me get a better sense of who they are, but also the interrelationships between them, because they talk shit about each other, you know, in this process. And so that I do that. That really takes some time to go through each one. Working out things, everything, like the religion in this story is really a big part of it. There's a lot of mythology. So I will take the time to write fables that go within the story that aren't actually in the story, but that the characters are all aware of. You know, all of this is like, takes a lot of time. It's not necessarily specifically on the page, but it's in my writer DNA, so that when I go to write it and they're referring to a particular story or a song, they all know about it and I know about it. Those sorts of things from world building, you know, it's a little bit extra, but I feel like, yeah.
It sounds like you're generating a lot of text.
I probably have 300,000 words of stuff to get to a 113,000 word novel.
Is part of that ever an actual step-by-step synopsis or outline before you start writing? Or is, again, it's all more of an organic thing?
I have a general outline. I used to outline heavily, but I found that for me, if I outline real specifically, then I feel like, okay, I already know what the story is. I don't need to write it.
I hear that sometimes, yeah.
And I wasn't interested. I've killed probably 3 or 4 novels by doing that. So now I don't do that. However, I do know where the end is. So for Season of the Dragon, I wrote the last chapter of that story about 5 years ago. And it's almost verbatim what I wrote 5 years ago. Very little change. And I've written the last chapter of the 5-book series. And we'll see how connected that goes. But I have a beginning and I have an end and I have a general idea of where they're going. But how they get there, and this is particularly true for relationships for the most part, the relationships between the people, I really don't know what's going to happen. I don't know who's going to live and who's going to die. And I really just try to let it flow organically and then see what happens.
So what does your actual writing process look like then? Are you plant yourself in front of your computer and work for a certain number of hours? Do you wander out and write with pen and parchment under a tree in the backyard? It could be hot in Arizona doing that. Or coffee shops? Where do you like to work? How do you like to work?
Yeah, I tend to work in my home office, and I have music going. It's not anything with words, because if it has words, I'll get distracted.
Yeah, that's so what I find too, yeah.
Yeah, it's you know, this kind of like, solfeggio harmonics. I tend to use things like that. And I usually meditate for a while before I sit down to do some new writing. And sometimes it's hard to get into whatever the piece is for the day. So I might do some warm-ups. You know, I'll interview a character or do a prompt that's completely unrelated to just kind of get the juices flowing if I'm feeling it difficult. I don't write every day, and I will go for months without writing anything on the story I'm working on, which is anathema to a lot of people. But what I find is that once I'm into the story, then though, I write every day. And it might be for 3 or 4 hours. And I then try to stay kind of in character for a while. You know what I'm saying? So like that might look like I'm writing 120,000 words in 3 months. But then I might just be writing some short stories and microfiction in between to keep myself, you know, kind of connected to writing. But because of the complex world building, I find it really difficult to get in and out of story. So I really try to keep it going once I'm in the engine of it, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, if I'm working on a novel and I switch and work on something else for a little bit, it's sometimes hard to get back into the flow of the story. I have to back up and read a bunch of stuff before I can remember, okay, this is how it pushes forward from there. So, interesting. And everybody's process is different, though.
Yeah, and I don't read back at all. I mean, I might read like a few pages, but when I finish a novel, I have not yet read that novel. You know, I've written it, but I haven't read it. So I used to go back, and then I would start questioning myself and editing. So now I just full steam ahead, and I get to the end, and then it's like, okay, I'm at an end, and I'll probably go back and cut a whole lot, you know, and rewrite, but just keep going, keep going, keep going. The best way out is through, and the only way through is to write it.
Well, that does bring me to the next question, is what does your revision and rewriting process look like?
That's also ugly. Because if you know, like George R. R. Martin says, he's a gardener, right? So if you have allowed that garden to, you know, just like run wild all over the place, you got to do a lot of shearing and pruning. So I tend to like overwrite. I put in, you know, I let characters sort of take me on side trips and all this sort of thing, but you got to get back to the main quest line at some point. So, you know, then I'm pruning and shearing and rewriting, and then the final piece is going through and really getting more fine tuning on that sentence level, and making sure that I'm really making every sentence crisp and, you know, allowing the lyricism and poetry to come through where I think it is appropriate.
Do you do multiple passes through?
Oh yeah. I don't know how many. Some chapters need more than others.
Do you always start at the beginning and work your way through, or do you pick and choose and jump around? Or
I tend to go from beginning to end, for the most part. Yeah.
Now you're self-publishing, so when you get to what you consider to be the final draft, do you then bring an editor on board, and what do they do for you? And what kind of things do they find in your writing that you don't find?
Yeah,
Or do you have a better readers in there, or beta readers in there?
No, I don't use beta readers. I definitely hire editors. I've used many. For Season of the Dragon, I actually had an agent, and I fired my agent, and then went through some other things. But I actually had probably 5 different editors over the course of the writing of Season of the Dragon. Mm. Some people early on, I have an editor that I will bring in early sometimes if I'm feeling adrift, and she will help me see, you know, what's working and what's not. But my last editor, I was, after I fired my first agent, I was trying to get an agent on board, and I was getting a lot of people requesting a full, and which is great. I mean, it's really unusual to get that many people. So I knew I had proof of concept, but they weren't picking it up. And I was like, why, what's going on here? So, I mean, I was getting a lot of like really good comments, but no one was saying anything negative, just it's not for me. And I'm like, okay, what does that mean? So I went to an editor who's worked with a lot of published writers, some of them who have won Hugos and Nebulas. And I'm like, okay, this guy is going to be expensive, but hopefully he can help me see what the issue is. And he just absolutely nailed it within like 5 pages. He's like, this is, I think, your problem. And I'm like, wow, okay. Literally probably a dozen editors over the years, no one pointed this out. No one could find it. You know what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. It was like an epiphany. It's like, oh my gosh, you're totally right. Like, this is something I'm doing consistently. And then once I had spent that money and that time, I felt like, you know what? I could wait for 10 years to see this thing be published through traditional channels. The people that like my writing, I already want it. So I just decided to go for it. And I have no regrets. The book is out and it's doing well and lots of people are reading it. And so, yeah.
Did you have
I probably paid more to the editor than I would have gotten for an advance. So at that point, I'm like, okay, I'm this deep in, I might as well just go for it.
Did you also have a copy editor? Do you have writing ticks that need to be caught? I know many of us do, that copy editors sometimes pick up on that we don't see.
Yeah, definitely. It goes through. So I have a content development editor, and then it goes through a copy edit. And then sometimes there's a line edit, you know, like a line edit, copy edit, and then a final proofread. This one, there was copy edit and proofread. And then, you know, and of course, I'm obviously doing my work on that too. I use Pro Writing Aid. Mm-hmm. That helps me pick up a lot of, you know, big errors and get that kind of cleaned up. And then from there, it goes to the copy edit. And then from there, it goes to the proofread. So there's, you know, I think I'm putting it through the same kind of rigorous process that traditional publishing used to use.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's considerably more rigorous than you actually get.
Yeah, yeah. So, so that hopefully by the time it gets to the reader, my goal is that my self-published works look and feel exactly like a traditionally published book, and you know, that no one would tell the difference.
You mentioned that you don't use beta readers, which I don't either. Do you show it to anybody else before it goes to the editing stage, other than the editor that you've hired?
Yeah, my husband, who is not a huge reader, but he is a lawyer as well, and he loves stories. He just tends to take them in more in terms of movies and such, but he is really good at pointing out when something is boring. Like the first draft of this, the first 100 pages, he's like, I can't even get through this. And I was like, oh, but he was totally right. So he helps me just kind of, you know, bounce ideas. And he's the first reader. And it's like, if he's got a big problem with it, then I know it's a problem.
So he's an alpha reader.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're going to use that terminology. Yeah.
Yeah, I've tried to use beta readers in the past, but they either just are like totally love everything, and that's not helpful. Or, you know, they're complaining about things that are nitpicky that isn't their preference, and that's not helpful either, because that thing that one person may dislike, 40 other people love. So I find that using paid editors helps me more.
Yeah, I just never got... And, you know, I talk to so many authors and they have this group of people that they think are wonderful. And I think, well, maybe my stuff would be better if I had beta readers. But like I said, 20 novels in and I seem to be doing okay. So,
yeah, I think I
often say that
some people.
Like the same reason I was never part of a writing group to speak of. I grew up in a small town and the only writing group was at the time elderly women writing about their depression era experiences. And I didn't think my space opera was going to actually...
Right.
Go over very well, so I never tried to join.
Right. I actually have that too. Here in Tucson, there are a lot of retired folks. And when you go to writing workshops and such, almost everyone is retirement age. And they're all writing memoir. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a different beast that it's not terribly helpful for them or for me to be engaged in that sort of, like, you know, critique partner kind of thing. So it can be difficult if you're not in an area. I'm sure there are a lot of sci-fi and fantasy writers here, and I know some, but when you go to like writing events, a lot of people that show up are people writing memoir, and it's just not the same.
I think the authors who find beta readers useful are the ones who have managed to find a really good group that provide what they need from them.
Right.
And I've just never tried, I guess. So I always ask that question because so many people do, and I'm always happy to find somebody else like me who doesn't. So, yay.
Yeah.
Well, you've talked about the publishing a bit. Was there I have my own publishing company, a traditional publishing company. I'm publishing other authors now. I just became a member. Shadowpaw Press just became a member of Literary Press Group of Canada, of all things. I never thought of myself as a literary publisher, but apparently I am now publishing stuff that makes me a literary publisher. So there was a big learning curve becoming a publisher. Did you find that when you started publishing yourself?
Oh yeah, I've learned a lot, but I study it a lot. I read, things and try to keep up on things and pay attention. And I had my own law practice for quite a number of years, so the entrepreneurial spirit I've always had. But just because you're an entrepreneur doesn't mean you're doing everything by yourself. So, really paying people who are experts in things and outsourcing things that, you can't do. Like, I can't do my own book covers. I can't do my own, editing. You have to hire these people. But just, I don't know, I would say I just was really a student of publishing and read as much as I could and talk to people and go to classes and then do things and do them badly and learn, waste time or money on things and learn, okay, that wasn't really useful or helpful. And then I haven't published anything since 2017, so there was a bit of a learning curve again because things have changed a lot
They change
in,
fast.
yes. And so you have to constantly be up on it and paying attention, and it's not easy. I think some people have the perception that being a small press or a self-publisher, that's like the easy way out. And there is no easy way to get readers. You know what I'm saying? So if you're an author, no matter how your book is coming out, you all still have to work really hard to ask the permission of their time. That, 'cause that's really what you're asking. It's not so much about the price of the book. Everyone can go get a book, you can get hundreds of books today for free. So it's not about price. I think it's about time and asking someone to commit the time to spend with your work. And so that's a big ask in a society where people are very pressed for time. And so whether you're self-published or traditionally published or hybrid published, doesn't matter. You're all trying to do the same thing. And so it's definitely a big learning curve. There's a lot to it, and it's not for the faint of heart, for sure, being a publisher.
I keep saying, somehow I'm putting out 14 books this year through Shadowpaw Press, and it's just me and the cat, and he's no help at all. So I'm not quite sure how that happened.
Yeah, that's a lot, Ed. I can't imagine.
I can't either, and I'm doing it,
I
but.
have a small press that I started and it has no books out because I thought it was going to be a good idea, but I think I was recovering from COVID and I don't know what was going on in my
That
brain.
old brain fog thing.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, it's this idea of publishing other people and but gosh, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
There's just so much to what every book that comes out. So I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
Well, that kind of brings us to the big philosophical questions at the end of our
Yeah.
interview here, because one of them is, why do you do this? Why do you write? Why do any of us do this? Why do we write? And in our cases, publish as well. And also, why stories of the fantastic specifically? So there are your three questions in whatever order you want to address them.
Yeah, wow. There's a lot there, but I would say the why I write, I think it's because I almost feel like I have to. Like, I went for a long period without writing, and I can tell you that my life is just better when I do, because I'm working through things. Sometimes I don't even know what I'm working through when I'm writing it. It's only in hindsight that I can say, oh, okay, that's what I'm noodling on, or what I'm struggling with, or working through. So there are these big questions like, why are we here? What are we doing? What is there after this? Is there anything after this? What's the point of all of this? of life, And I feel like sci-fi and fantasy address those questions better than any other genre. I think a lot of people that don't read sci-fi and fantasy, like I don't know if you've ever gotten this. Oh, I bet that was fun to write. Oh, I bet that was just fun to write. It's like, fun? That was not fun. That was freaking torture. The idea of trying to get through these ideas and get them out on a page in a fashion that someone would find interesting, and yet still maintain the theme and all of that. It's all very difficult, but
I think it's the compliment of that it looks effortless from their perspective. So
yeah, or people that read or write a lot of literary fiction. I think the tendency is to think that those of us writing sci-fi and fantasy were just over here, tra-la-la, you know, it's just all fairies and dragons and fun. And yeah, there is that. I mean, certainly there's the entertainment value. But, you know, religious texts and are written, all works of, you know, where you're trying to really teach someone something important, they're written in allegory and in, you know, metaphor for a reason. It's because humans learn that way. And so I personally have always felt that from Lord of the Rings to Star Wars and everything in between, you know, those stories are always addressing really big questions. And, you know, so that's where I feel at home, is that place where it's that synergy between pure entertainment and addressing the big questions. And that's where I feel, you know, most at home.
Then where do you think the impulse in general from all types of writers and storytellers, why do we do this as human beings? Why do we tell stories?
Yeah, I think it's essential. Personally, I think that it's one of the first things we probably did, whether it was around the fire or drawing on cave walls. We literally can't be humans without telling stories, without having stories. So as a storyteller, I could write and work through whatever issues, concerns, questions I have and just put it in a drawer and go on with my day. But I guess my assumption is that if somehow it was meaningful to me and I found that it moved my life along or helped me, that maybe it would help someone else. So that's why I publish. And so, you know, people reach out to you and they say, hey, you know, I really like that. It spoke to me. I was going through something similar, or I relate to that character. I tend to write about misfit characters, the ones that don't belong, that feel like they're, you know, just not quite on the inner circle. And so I think that my readers tend to be people who feel that way in some respect in their lives.
And what are you working on now?
Well, right now I have material that I had written before for the backstory of Season of the Dragon. And I'm wrapping those together into a companion piece that will come out in November that will be called The Saga of Ilkay and Other Stories. And so within Season of the Dragon, Quinn, the main character, has a favorite book called The Saga of Ilkay. And so I wrote that book, as well as some of the other pieces of fables and lore. And I'm putting those in an illustrated volume that will be a companion. And then I'm also writing right now book two, which will tentatively is titled Search for the Spring Dragon. And that should be out, I hope it will be out in 2025. 2024 is, I'm not going to quite have it ready, but I'm working on that and planning the others as well. So this series will be five main volumes, and it will also be five companion volumes.
For the illustrated companion piece, are you doing your own illustrations? Have you gotten back to art at that level?
No.
I was an art minor in university. So.
Yeah,
I don't try to do my own art, that's for sure.
My undergraduate degree is in art education. No, my son actually is an art student in New York City, and he is home for the summer, and his rent payment is making art for me. So I have a cover artist in France, a lovely young woman. She's doing the cover art, and then my son will be doing interior illustration.
I have a niece who's an artist, and she illustrated my collection of science fiction and fantasy poetry and is going to be illustrating the latest anthology that I've kickstarted featuring authors who've been on the podcast here. So it's nice to have it in the family.
It is.
And where can people find you online?
My online home is nataliewrightauthor.com. And on almost all social media, I'm Natalie Wright Author, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, etc.
Oh, you got that memo. All of mine are different. So E. Willett, Edward Willett Author, Edward Willett, Edward Dot Willett. I'm all over the place. Well, thank you so much for being on, Natalie. That was a fun conversation. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me.
And Best of luck with the book that's out now and with getting that second one out in 2025.
Yes.
And yeah, so thanks so much. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks again to Natalie Wright for that terrific interview. I certainly enjoyed it, and I hope you did as well. That's the end of episode 139 of The World Shapers. Just some housekeeping notes. Reminder that you can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. You can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers and on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find Shadow Paw Press, which I mentioned off the top, and I forgot to mention in my intro that, of course, there are so far three anthologies of short fiction by guests of this podcast: Shapers of Worlds, Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, Shapers of Worlds Volume 3. Shapers of Worlds Volume 4 is in the works and will be coming out commercially. That one might also slip into 2024 again, so I can take advantage of the sales force and all of that through Literary Press Group. But the Kickstarter backers will get theirs probably in October, November timeframe. I'll get it ahead of the commercial release, I think. But it is coming. Shapers of Worlds, Volume 4. My current guests are my fifth-year guests, and I do anticipate doing a Kickstarter next spring for Shapers of Worlds, Volume 5. Anyway, that's all published by Shadow Paw Press, which you can find at shadowpawpress.com. It's on Twitter at Shadow Paw Press, and on Facebook at Shadow Paw Press, and on Instagram at Shadow Paw Press. It does have a YouTube channel, but there's nothing much on it at the moment. And then you can find me online at edwardwillett.com. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett, two T's on Willett, always. You can find me on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor, on Facebook at edward.willett, and on YouTube at edwardwillett. And on the YouTube channel there, I have lots and lots of stuff, because four or five times a week I will walk somewhere in my hometown here of Regina, Saskatchewan, and you can walk with me. Either walk with me literally when I'm doing the live stream, or watch the recording later and see a little bit of our town here. And that's that. So thanks again for listening to this episode of The World Shapers, and I hope you will come back many more times in the future as I continue to interview the authors of the science fiction and fantasy stories that we all enjoy reading so much. That's it for this time. Bye for now.